space his poems inhabit. Longing is a shape for this emptiness. In A Ghazal by Jalaluddin Rumi, love is nakedly exposed and restless like a mountain creek, like sunlight moving around a winter room. Emptiness is where his sama leads us, sama being the deep listening to poetry and its surround of music and movement. Within sama, one remembers the disillusion of the ego and the non-attachment of the heart. Rumi explores many images for this place, presence, this unnameable state. The empty heart, as revealed in Rumi's odes, is a composite experience of many valences: praise, complaint, majesty, stubbornness, generosity, splendor, bitterness, hesitation, and union. The poems were very new to me in 1976. They did not care about understanding or memorializing a moment. Mind and personality were barely there, vague, dissolving paradigms. The poems lived free of purpose, free of time and space, in a kind of pure sailing. In those first months of discovering Rumi, I would go down after teaching to the Bluebird Restaurant in Athens, Georgia, and have tea. Sitting there in the late fall afternoon, working with Arbery's scholarly translations, was such a relief after making sense all day. This poetry could not possibly be explicated. I loved the unpredictable spontaneity, the push-pull of great tenderness and great loneliness, of living beyond psychology, of drifting at ease inside the unsayable. Sometimes the poems seemed to take place on the porch of a madhouse. They stepped out of the normal with an almost inhuman energy. Other times they felt exhausted. No one can say what such friendship is. In the commingling, I heard a voice saying something close to my own sense of failure, joy, grief, ecstasy. Why is it so difficult to say the content of Rumi's ghazals? I feel happy inside them, continuous, whole, in the simplicity of just taking in sunlight, no pretext, no excuse, empty in the present moment. The Hebrew word makom refers to the sacred as a location. One can live in the heart. Rumi's odes speak from there and invite us in as though to a galactic residence of inferiority. I felt drawn to the vast beauty of that. Because of these troubles we are living in, I want to call attention again to Rumi's role as a bridge between religions and cultures. Everyone knows the story of how representatives from all faiths came to his funeral. His presence and his poetry was, and is, inclusive, allied with the impulse to praise and recognize every being and every moment as sacred. Interfaith hardly reaches the depth of his connecting. Rumi speaks from the clear bead at the center. The religions of the world are luminous in their individuality, and they have valuable social and soul-making functions. Surely someday we will quit killing each other over their different strategies. But let us be honest. I have no hope, nor do you, that the Middle East warring, or anywhere else, will stop in this lifetime, or in our grandchildren's. No hope. But perhaps hope is overrated. Who needs it? Let us continue on with our battered guidon, which has no recognizable insignia. As Whitman advises us in the 1855 preface to Leaves of Grass, argue not concerning God, re-examine all you have been told at church or school or in any book, dismiss whatever insults your soul. I say that the exclusivity of most of the organized religions does insult the soul. We must be open enough to assimilate the insights of indigenous cultures as well as those of the Abrahamic religions, to glory in the clarity of Rinzai and Bodhidharma, as well as that of the Dreamtime drawings. Joseph Campbell teaches us this. It feels mean-spirited and academic to dismiss as syncretic Rumi's healing universal tolerance. His place among world religions is as a dissolver of boundaries. He is the ocean that acknowledges oneness, the seawater, over the multiplicity of waves, our individual circumstances. Mystical poetry can be a subject for study, but in its essential nature, it is not something to locate or